pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Wish You Were Here, a collection of essays from the editor of Our State magazine, by Elizabeth Hudson. A House Filled. My parents talk of moving out of their house, the house I grew up in, the house they built 32 years ago. It's just the two of them now, and they're getting weary of the amount of work it takes to keep a house up, to wash the windows, to carry laundry up and down stairs, to dislodge the wasp nests that form under the eaves, to keep the yard mowed and raked. And so, maybe, they say, it's time to find a home that's more manageable, more efficient, a place better suited to their needs. I know it's not an easy decision to come to leave a place filled with so many memories, so much history. I remember when this house was being built, before it had any history at all. My parents and I would drive out every week to check on it, excited to see what sort of progress had been made on our new home. Go inside the house now and you'll see evidence of a full life. Old scales and thermometers hang in the den, reminders of my parents' once thriving fervor for antiques. A large needlework sampler, once displayed in my mom's craft store, decorates the hallway. My grandmother's china cabinet stands in the corner of the dining room, holding a collection of Seagrove pottery. A wall of cabinets in a spare bedroom holds my dad's cameras and equipment from the photography studio he had many years ago. This house is filled with so much. It's filled with the smell of Saturday afternoon fried chicken and milk gravy, and Wednesday meatloaf, and my dad's spaghetti sauce simmering on the stove. It's filled with the oily aroma of lighter fluid and charcoal burning on the grill in the summertime. It's filled with the lazy light of afternoon streaming through the windows. Our dog, Muffin, loved to lie on the floor and warm her back in a pool of that sunshine, and if I listen carefully, I can hear how this house was filled, too, with the sound of her feet clipping up the stairs in the morning. This house is filled with the quiet play of an only child, and later, it's filled with the never-ending ring of a telephone, once a lifeline for a teenage girl. It's filled with the hushed whispers of my parents' late-night kitchen-table conversations the year they decided to close their business. It's filled with the sound of laughter over Sunday night television, all of us together in the den watching MASH or Newhart. And it's filled with the soft twang of my mom's accent, the one I have, too, singing, while she sweeps, the forgotten songs of Loretta Lynn and John Denver. Country roads, take me home. But through the years, things have changed. Now this house is no longer in the country. Town has edged in. The place isn't as remote as it once was. There's a grocery store a mile up the road. There are stoplights and heavy tractor trailers that whiz by at all hours of the day and night. And so, maybe they're right. Maybe it's time to let go, to find a new space to fill. This house, which once held promise, now only holds the past. And my parents can take that with them when they go. Full Circle. We got dropped off in the gravel parking lot outside Jones Skating Rink, and when our parents drove off for the evening, we took our places outside in the line to get in, shy and awkward and self-conscious, but pretending that we were none of those things. Some kids carried their own skates, dangling them from the laces over their arms, but most of us had to rent. Scuffed white for the girls, faded black for the boys. Inside, our eyes adjusted to the dim light, and Rod Stewart rasped about young hearts feeling free tonight, and everything smelled sugary and sweaty, a heady mixture of hubba-bubba bubblegum that we packed in our cheeks, and tickle deodorant that we'd just started to use, a requirement of dressing out in P.E. at school. Learning to skate is not easy, but somehow we managed to figure out how to glide side to side, how to push off with our legs, how to hold on to the rail along the wall, how to hold on to a boy's back pocket, fingers hooked into the slim space next to his comb. We did the best we could, trying not to look so shy and awkward and self-conscious, by keeping ourselves moving, going around and around in circles, all of us in unison, some of us learning to skate backward, retrograde, flying around the rink with our knees bent and our necks craned to see if we were going to run into anyone, which we somehow, miraculously, never did, and not once realizing that all life is a series of rotations, of revolutions, cycles and circles. I still remember how it feels to skate around that rink, leaning into the curves, and it makes me remember other things, too, like how I cried the first time I rode the Oaken Bucket at Carowinds, a standing ride that suspended you against a wall by centrifugal force as it spun around and around and the bottom dropped away, leaving you with the terrifying feeling that you would plummet to who knows where if this ride ever stopped turning, which it most certainly would. And there were other moments of revolutions that now I recognize as revelations. The Lazy Susan in the center of the kitchen table at my grandmother's house that held her W. Dalton china, serenity pattern, and how my grandmother and I sat at that table and played tea time with her fanciest china, how we spun the Lazy Susan around and around to turn the creamer or sugar bowl toward each other, and how her entire collection now graces my own china cabinet, plates that I use for everything, even if I'm only grilling a cheeseburger for myself, because she would have said to make every day a special day. And I remember, too, how later, on the porch at her house, we watched the metal canister down in the wooden ice cream freezer turning, going around and around, churning out the first batch of vanilla that we couldn't wait to taste for the first time in the summer, and how afterward she let me race to the backyard where she set up a sprinkler, and I ran around and around in wide circles, barefooted, dodging the streams of water shooting from its rotating base, hearing the f-f-f-f-f-f of water arcing across the yard while I flailed my outstretched arms like an octopus, not shy or awkward or self-conscious at all, and never considering how much I would miss when this sprinkler stopped turning, which it most certainly would. Friday Night Fish Fry. To get to Little Texas Fish Camp from my house in Randolph County, you had to cross a one-lane bridge that ran beside a dam. The bridge was past the round of a curve, and it was tricky business to watch for headlights from an approaching car. If one was coming, you'd either gun it to get across first, or ease over to the side and wait your turn. Other fish houses were easier to get to in Asheboro, but in my memory, nothing was better than Little Texas. On Friday nights, my parents and I went for the all-you-can-eat flounder, thick strips of fried fish stretched across the whole length of a platter, hush puppies you could eat like popcorn, tartar sauce, a pile of slaw, its sweet juice pooling out onto the plate. I never thought of Little Texas as a seafood restaurant. To me, and everyone else who went there, it was just a fish house, plain and simple. A nondescript block building set in a dip between two hills next to the Uwari River in the middle of the woods, a place with paper placemats on the tables, tiled with squares of ads for appliance or car repair in Denton and real estate sellers in Asheboro. The place was always packed on weekends with families like mine, and the air hung thick with a mixture of oil from the fryers and cigarette smoke. You'd carry that smell on your clothes when you left. At the end of the meal, we'd walk out into the dark Uwari night, my dad or grandfather working a toothpick, me twirling a lemon sucker in my mouth. There was nothing simpler and nothing more satisfying. Back then, Little Texas tasted, smelled, and looked like everything I knew of Randolph County, which is to say, everything I knew of North Carolina. It was wood paneling and spindleback chairs. It was sweet tea in a styrofoam cup. It was pickup trucks and Chevrolet Camaros pulled into the gravel parking lot. It was the primitiveness of an old one-lane bridge, and the comfort of riding in the back seat of a car at night, watching for headlights to show on the other side, and trusting the driver to carry you across safely. It was a reminder that all you needed at the end of a good week was a familiar place to go. Many of the old fish camps I remember have dwindled. People go to different restaurants now, places where the fish has been shipped in from thousands of miles away. Little Texas has closed, and a two-lane bridge was built beside of the one-lane bridge. I worry sometimes that the tastes of things I remember are changing. And then, once in a while, I'm surprised. Not long ago, I spent a few days in Bogue and Pamlico Sounds in a small fishing boat with people from the North Carolina Coastal Federation. For 2 days, we talked about fish. We waded in the Sounds. We ate at Riverview Cafe and Sneed's Ferry, fried flounder and soft-shell crabs. And we made a stop at a place called J&B Aquafood, an oyster farm. The owner, Jim Swartzenberg, explained his whole operation. And then he held a fresh oyster in the palm of his hand and slid his pocket knife into the lip of the shell. It popped open, and he offered it to me, my first raw one ever, its liquid shimmering and spilling over the sides. I took it and tipped it into my mouth, and immediately tasted clusters of salt and sea and waves. Then, in one easy, silky mouthful, it tasted like everything I've ever known, which is to say, it tasted like North Carolina. It was dirt, like the country roads I knew, and metallic, like a cast-iron skillet. It was ocean air, and a cool spring house, and a weathered landscape, and fish houses, and one-lane bridges that carry you straight across the water. It was a tiny little oyster, plain and simple. Miles away from my roots, it tasted like home. Fall back. For 17 days in autumn, I sat in the waiting room of the surgical ICU at Moses Cone Hospital in Greensboro, while my dad lay in a hospital bed, intubated with a ventilator, a machine breathing for him. It was a horrible thing to see, my dad swollen with the 20 extra pounds of fluid that surgery pumped in, a medusa of tubes, machines rigged to his body. He had surgery for a diseased lung on a Tuesday, then another surgery for a blood clot on Wednesday. 12 days after that, the doctors shocked his heart to correct its irregular rhythm. Then, pneumonia. Just as he started to recover from one thing, something else happened to set him back. Every day, my mom drove from Ashboro to sit by his bedside. She woke up every morning at 5 a.m., showered, drove the dark highway before the sun came up, and stayed at the hospital until visiting hours ended at 7 p.m. Clocks are everywhere in the hospital. In my dad's room on the second floor, a clock was behind the bed, and a clock was in front of the bed. The hospital has 518 patient beds, and each room has at least one clock. Many have two. Clocks hang outside each room, too, and on every hall. Clocks are in the half-dozen central waiting rooms. Clocks are in the 16 operating rooms. I don't know why there are so many clocks. Anyone who's been in a hospital knows that time stands still. Here, everyone is watching a clock, waiting for something, waiting for news, waiting for a doctor, waiting for recovery. They told my dad, "It's just going to take time." This year, daylight savings time ends on November 6, and all those clocks, the ones beside the 518 beds, the ones in the rooms, in the hallways, in the waiting areas, will automatically adjust back an hour. Reverting back to standard time in the fall moves an hour of sunlight from the evening to the morning. It means that if my mom is still driving to the hospital each morning, she won't be in the dark. This November, a time of Thanksgiving, I'm grateful for the smallest things that can make the days easier, that give a little relief. Sunlight in the morning. Clear autumn skies. Hot coffee from a vending machine. Casseroles packed in Tupperware. Strangers who care for people they don't even know. On day 17 in the hospital, when I walked into my dad's room, he had his eyes open. I've noticed how much my own dark eyes look just like his. He still had his ventilator, and he couldn't talk, but he was holding a pen and scrawling notes on a piece of paper. My throat hurts. I wish I could have some water. Nose itches. I watched my mom rub her thumb across my dad's nose. A small thing. A little relief. On day 17, my mom and I were leaving the critical care ward for the evening. My dad lifted his hands, reaching for us. My mom held onto one of his hands. I held onto the other. The nurse stood in the doorway and watched us. "What a sweet family," she said. My dad squeezed our fingers tight, closed his eyes, and nodded. I felt the wave of peace wash over the three of us. And time stood still. From scratch. Saturday morning, nearly 40 years ago, and here's what's on the kitchen table at my grandmother's house. 6 eggs and 2 sticks of butter warming to room temperature. A box of swan's down flour. A metal measuring bowl full of sugar. A tiny bottle of vanilla extract. My grandmother made her pound cakes on Saturdays, and I loved watching her work. By themselves, the ingredients on the table were nothing special. But in my grandmother's hands, they transformed into something magnificent. I was mesmerized by the steps, how she smeared butter with her fingertips into the bottom of the pans, how she sprinkled flour on the pans and tilted them to knock it loose, how she cracked eggs with 2 fingers and measured milk by holding the glass cup up to eye level to see the faded line marker, how she scraped the sides of the mixing bowl and then passed me the spatula to lick. So many things can go wrong with a cake. Too dry, sticks to the pan, crumbly, sinks in the middle, domes on top. But my grandmother's, somehow, were always perfect. If cooking is an imprecise art, and baking is a science, then cakes, surely, are one level deeper. Chemistry. All the elements, ordinary ingredients by themselves, must come together in such a precise way to create the right reaction. My grandmother knew to alternate dry and wet ingredients, first flour, then milk, then flour, but she probably didn't know the chemical reasons why it must be this way. Otherwise, too much protein gluten forms and makes the cake tough. Mix, not too much, not too little, and then carefully slide into the oven. For the next 50 minutes, I'd sit at the table and color quietly, dangling my feet and trying not to move around too much, for fear of causing the cake to fall. Cakes, by their nature, are fragile. They require tenderness, patience, and care. Thinking back, it was a complicated process that took about 2 hours, start to finish. I guess it's that precise process that gives cakes their character, that makes a cake what it is, something special. A cake is simultaneously refined and down-home, and by its very construction, it towers above all other desserts. It's no wonder we put them on pedestals. And it's why cakes, more than cookies, more than pies, more than puddings or cobblers, are the ultimate expression of love and celebration. Cakes mark special occasions, birthdays, anniversaries, weddings, grand events. My grandmother made a cake nearly every Saturday. For her, all of life was a special occasion. In our own expression of love for North Carolina, we created 5 original cakes that, to our knowledge, don't exist anywhere outside the pages of this magazine. For months, we worked with a recipe developer and a baker to create our versions of North Carolina cakes, using nearly all local ingredients, and recalling flavors that give us North Carolinians our character, too. Pimento cheese, country ham, Krispy Kreme donuts, Nabs, Pepsi, and peanuts. A little unexpected, maybe, but that's the other beautiful thing about cakes. Even when you're expecting them, they always seem to surprise. I remember how my grandmother made her cakes nearly 40 years ago. The process, for anyone who cares to take it on, is still the same. slow, deliberate, but the result is always a masterpiece. This road. Outside the southwest city limits of Asheboro, NC Highway 49, a connector between Raleigh and Charlotte, splits. Veer off to the right, past the old Yates Country Ham Building and the Asheboro Animal Hospital, and you're traveling on old NC Highway 49. It's a nice drive. Old 49 is still a quiet country road with plain-built houses and pine trees, and open fields spotted with baled hay and horses. About a mile into the drive, you see the gentle rise of the Uwaries. I grew up on this road, in a house on a hill. After I got my driver's license, I burned up this road and all its offshoots. I drove it back and forth to school, high school first, then later when I went west to Appalachian State University. On weekend nights, I shuttled my friends from Farmer and Denton and Jackson Creek, all of us piling into my car to go to town and drive some more. Back then, everyone in the country went to the city to cruise Fayetteville Street. Town, as we called Asheboro proper, was a good 20-minute drive from wherever you happened to be on old Highway 49. When we got to town, we followed the cruising etiquette established decades before we got to this road. Start out on the south end and fall into the line of traffic, a teenage-led procession of Camaros and Mustangs and pickup trucks. Drive north past Hardee's, past the bowling alley on the hill, past Sir Pizza, past McDonald's, to the shopping center anchored by Roses. Then loop around in the parking lot and start all over. The point of cruising was to keep moving. At the end of an evening cruising, I took my friends home, back down Old 49 toward Farmer and Denton and Jackson Creek. I had this road all to myself again. I loved driving Old 49 at night. The periphery disappeared into the darkness. You didn't see the trees anymore, or the power lines, or the fields or the houses. You saw only the road, a black asphalt river stretching in front of the car no farther than headlights and the stars overhead allowed. The shortened sight distance made driving intimate. It connected you to the road in a way that driving in the daytime can't, where there are other distractions, other things to pull your attention away from what is laid out right in front of you. It's funny how you get to know something so well that you know every detail about it. I've driven Old 49 so often in my life, I could navigate it blindfolded. I know its smooth, straight stretches, and its ruts, and how much to ease off the gas around its sharpest turns. I know where to watch for deer that could come bounding out of the darkness. One day, I know I won't drive this road anymore. My friends all live elsewhere now, and when the day comes and my parents are gone, there will be no reason for me to come back. There's talk of a major highway coming through 100 yards from my parents' house, bisecting Old 49 at the top of the hill. That'll surely change the road I know. We have more than 100,000 miles of public roads in North Carolina, with more constructed each year. It's a good thing, I suppose. It keeps us moving. There are places I remember that don't exist anymore, places that have been completely rerouted. U.S. Highway 220 South going to Asheboro has expanded. There's a lake under the bridge at Randleman. So many of the old roads I knew are different now. At night, in the dark, though, they still look the same. Black asphalt rivers that stretch endlessly into a distance that you can't see. Christmas Magic. Christmas came to my house on December 1st, the day my mom hung the Advent calendar on the closet door in the hallway. For the next 24 days, I unwrapped the tiny presents that appeared in the little pockets. The calendar was silkscreen linen, handmade in Denmark. It had 24 small pockets sewn into the front, beneath a screen-printed image of children circling a Christmas tree. Every morning when I got up, still in my pajamas, my mom and I walked together to check the Advent calendar, and there would be a new toy, folded neatly inside a Kleenex, or wrapped in a tiny piece of brown wrapping paper, peeking out from one of the pockets. I can still remember how excited I got by all this, seeing a toy popping up from one of those pockets, as if it had appeared there by magic. After work at night, My mom stopped at the Quick Check on her way home and bought toys from the vending machine in the doorway. She stuffed the pockets of the advent calendar with all kinds of things. Plastic ring whistles, squares of Bazooka Joe gum, a rubber high-bounce ball, and ceramic animal figurines, a duck, a cow, a frog, each one about the size of a penny. One year, each pocket held a different pewter miniature. There was a candlestick collection, each one about half the size of a toothpick. I got a tiny set of pewter dishes, 4 plates and 4 cups, a pewter iron, a pewter mirror, brush and comb, a pewter fireplace shovel and stoker. On Christmas Day that year, I woke up to find a dollhouse beneath our tree. It was beautiful, a 2-story white wooden farmhouse, and it was electrified. Each room had tiny sconces mounted on the walls, and when the lights were lit, the whole house glowed. The front facade of the house was on hinges, and you could swing the entire piece forward to get to the rooms inside. There was a living room and kitchen, a staircase, 2 bedrooms, and 2 bathrooms. There was a fireplace, and I jumped up to get the candlestick set from my advent calendar and placed it inside on the mantle. Such a tiny thing that filled in the empty space. It made the house seem complete. The dollhouse was one of the best Christmas presents I ever got, and I spent hours stretched out on the floor in front of it, arranging furniture, imagining scenarios inside it, creating stories for its little people. Years later, my parents told me about driving to Davidson to buy that dollhouse. They found a craftsman who had a shop across the street from Davidson College, and they went to look at what he had. I can imagine the two of them walking on the sidewalk at Christmas time, admiring the decorations, stopping at the soda shop for a hot dog lunch, and looking in all the store windows for Christmas presents for their little girl. I can imagine how excited my mom must have been seeing that house on display in the shop window. Its front opened up to a miniature, happy home that reminded her of our own. I can imagine the smile spreading across my dad's face when he loaded that house up in the truck bed, wrapping a blanket around the structure so it wouldn't get damaged on the drive back home. My parents gave me the best childhood Christmases. I guess that wasn't magic after all. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.